Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 100. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com. Ben Flanagan of AL.com. Graham Flanagan of Business Insider. Franco Usmile of Dawn of the Dad.
Craig, how are you doing today?
Good. How about you?
Very good. So it's a very special issue of Film Nerds Unlimited. We've been doing this for almost a year now, and we have hit 100 episodes. All of which are of superb quality, and from every possible perspective. So yes. What we decided to do is for our 50th episode or issue, we talked about our top three favorite directors, which was for everybody quite an excruciating list to put together. So what we're doing for our 100th is an even more excruciating experience, which is to pick our three favorite movies of all time and talk about them. So it's I think this is a tough thing for any, you know, hardcore film fan to narrow down to just three movies, but this is it. So are you ready to talk about your movies?
I was going to say, you know, ask you why you had to make it so difficult, but that's good that you're kicking this thing off by acknowledging how excruciating this is. You know, if you had said maybe like a top 100, now that I can do. Top three
sure.
is so hard.
Do you have a top 100? Do you have like a spreadsheet or a list or something?
Yeah, I've got a top 100, and then I've got like a separate list of movies that were ever in the top 100.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and interesting and disturbing. But it's, you know, I want to remember what I used to think was worthy enough to be in the top 100. So I kept a list of those movies as well as best I could. But yeah, top three, I was able to just concede my top three, by looking at my top 10, which is really hard to do. But yeah, it was just that the last time I ranked my top 10, it is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. I redid my, I did like a top 100 like a year ago. I do it every few years. And then I redid my top 10 around the same time. And that's something I kind of look at every 6 months, every 3 months, because I'm a total narcissist. And so the last time I did my top 10, I guess I did a pretty good job because it's kind of sitting well with me. And so I looked at my top three and I was like, all right, let me critically look at these to make sure I'm being extreme, like totally honest with myself here. I was thinking maybe I needed to swap a few out at first, but then I really looked at it and, it's actually, I guess I've gone through a lot of the excruciating stuff before. So this is basically me just, you know, going into my existing top three movies. So do you want me to go first or do you want to go first?
I don't know.
You go first.
Let's spend a few minutes. I'm just kidding. Okay.
Please.
We're going down. We're starting with three.
Starting with three, right.
Oh, boy.
That's okay. Your third. We're going in the order of 3, 2, 1, not 1, 2, 3. No,
okay.
No hatchet order here. So
if the listeners were to watch my top three, they should watch them in this order. I should just say my third favorite movie of all time. That sounds weird, though. It makes me want to change my top three. But anyways, my third favorite movie of all time is The Godfather.
Yeah. Pretty solid pick there. Solid.
Yeah. It's... And quite frankly, the more I listen, the more I watch it, the more I kind of just stare in awe at all the different things about this movie that make it as good as it is. And even if you want to, especially when you consider, I believe the studios offered this movie to 12 directors before they finally said, okay, fine, Francis Ford Coppola, you can do it. And those 12 directors are some of the best directors of all time. And this the movie that came from all that is such a masterpiece in every technical aspect of cinema, from storytelling to lighting. It's perfect. And storytelling is probably one of the most important, probably the most important thing in a movie, maybe one of the, definitely one of them. But if all the other technical aspects are great, the story sucks, then who cares really, you know? But yeah, this is just, it's just a wonderful movie, and it's just incredible that every time I watch it, I'm kind of noticing more things about it. I read the book. I'd seen the movie a long time ago, but then I'd read the book, and I really enjoyed that book. It was a bestseller for over a year, and I want to say it was one of the top grossing books when it was published in the late 60s.
Right, it was super popular. I mean, that's why this was a big blockbuster movie.
Yeah, Mario Puzo.
Yep.
I'm not sure how you pronounce that. The single Z,
right,
in the Italian names, but I'm pretty sure it's one of those two. It's a great book. And it's actually the first two Godfathers rolled into one. I really like how they tell the story there. But it's a very engaging book. One of my favorite books of all time, actually. You know, if you appreciate loyal adaptations like I do, then you'll appreciate the movie even more as well. A young director to go in and take these group of actors, cast them perfectly, I don't want to say they weren't a ragtag bunch, were they? No, but they were all very good and professional. They're very good at what they do, but it's just crazy to see these guys, you know, what, 45 years later, to say, oh, these guys were young and sort of at the beginning of their careers when they made this, and how they made something so incredible. I like Al Pacino. Back then, you think of Godfather, I think even up to Dog Day Afternoon, to me, Al Pacino is a different actor than he is when you consider kind of the, like, impersonations that people do of him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. He's so reserved. I mean, that's, in my opinion, that's kind of the strength of The Godfather, is this quiet anger that's just kind of, like, simmering underneath his performance the whole time.
Yeah, totally. I was just about to use that very word, reserved. What was he, like, he just got down with the war. He was a Marine, maybe. And you think you'll kind of look at him, and he wants nothing to do with the family business. He wants a quiet life, which is totally understandable from someone that just got out of World War II. I can't help but think, man, what have you seen? You know, what did you go through? And then I can understand how you wouldn't want anything to do with a violent life after that. And he doesn't. And so from the get-go, we find ourselves, aligning ourselves with him, you know, supporting him and that call, I think. I think he's forced into his role just as you or I might be if something, you know, when the attack on his family sort of brings him into that. And he's sort of, now it's deeply, deeply personal. And he's a changed man in that regard. And so the decision to probably retaliate is not one that's hard to argue with. So I think with the audience can kind of relate to Michael Corleone and throughout that whole character arc of his. I also love Robert Duvall's character. He's kind of the outsider. But he's a very trusted, you know, and he's like as close as anyone can be to Vito, but he's, you know, not really a family member, and he's not Italian. So I don't know. What do you think about this movie?
Yeah, it's a pretty good movie. No, it's great. It's one of those that I like, you know, every few years, because I didn't grow up watching The Godfather. So it was one that I didn't watch for the first time until high school or college.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
Every few years it's like, well, I bet that movie's overrated. You know, so many people like it. It can't be that good. And then I watch it. I'm like, oh, never mind. It's great. It's exactly as good as everybody says it is. And it's, you know, it's the metaphor for America that Coppola does so well in Patton and in Patton and in Tucker, A Man in His Dream and Apocalypse Now. I mean, it's such a good movie about America, and there's so many different analogs. You know, I mean, Robert Duvall's Tom character is basically like an immigrant to this family, and this family, you know, is faced with this kind of, you know, descent into darkness when they're attacked the same way that America, you know, had to choose to go into World War II after Pearl Harbor. So there's all of these kind of, and the whole thing is an immigrant story, you know, of course, when it's continued
right.
in Godfather Part II. So and from the opening line, you know, about, it's all about America, and it's just a great picture, and it came at such a good historical moment to tell this story. And you mentioned the cinematography, and it all melds together. There's the idea that, you know, like all of the shadows in Gordon Willis's cinematography, you know, those shadows, that's where the family operates, and that's where Michael is kind of constantly drawn to. So even the cinematography has, you know, thematic and character overtones to them. So yeah, it's a masterpiece and a great pick for your number three. I'm excited to see what your other two are. But I'll go into my number three, which is Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. It's a movie that I knew was important before I saw it. I got into Kurosawa, you know, in late high school, early college, and you know, there's that austere Japanese film grammar and that you see in the movies of like Ozu, and it's like admirable, I guess. But there is a Western quality to Kurosawa's movies that just works so well with, I think, our Western sensibilities. And the way that Kurosawa moves his camera, the places he puts it, the way he cuts, the close-ups, the wide shots, the rhythm of everything, especially in Seven Samurai, it's like an 80s action movie, you know, 30 years early. It's obviously all the tropes are there of the kind of the masculinity of these tough guys, you know, just kind of doing a job and trying to stay dispassionate. There's so much in this movie that, as a fan of action movies, you know, you can draw a line from most action movies to Seven Samurai, most, you know, action film techniques. You can draw a line to Seven Samurai, but that's just treating it as a totally shallow action movie, which it's not just that. It's also a movie about humanity. It's a movie about fear. It's about what fear leads us to do, and it's a movie about exploitation and what we'll do to protect what's important to us, and what we'll make other people do to keep that safe. So it's a really poignant movie. It's a movie that it's super long, but it moves so quickly that it doesn't feel that long. You know, the way that it just jumps from situation to situation. It's almost episodic in a way, but because it's all leading up to this one climactic battle in the rain at the end, it's you know, it always feels like every scene is necessary. And again, the places that Kurosawa puts his camera, the way that he combines faces with backgrounds in some shots, the way that there's this amazing sequence in early in the first act where a samurai poses as a monk to rescue a kidnapped child, and the way that the violence that all culminates in, the way that he films that is so counterintuitive and so unlike anything that you would have seen in other movies in the 50s, but the way he cuts between several planes of action, between slow motion, but it all makes sense, the eye lines all match up, and it all has a huge emotional resonance. It's just stellar filmmaking across the board, and it's my favorite movie from one of my favorite directors.
That's a solid pick right there. I remember when I first saw this, I saw this late in probably my movie watching days. It was after I was out of college, actually. It was about 10 years ago the first time I saw it. My friend had the Criterion Collection on DVD, let me borrow it. I saw how long it was and that it was, Japanese, I guess. And not because it's Japanese, but because it was the Japanese language and it had subtitles. Okay, so don't start. Anyways, I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch the first disc right now, and I'm going to watch the next disc tomorrow. I don't want to put too much on myself because I tend to, that can really affect how you react to a film when you watch it. So I put it in. Before I knew it, I was popping in the next disc, and it was over. And it was just like, what a great experience. I love movie experiences like that, even if it's on your couch watching it on a TV, when you're so glued to it that the idea of it being too long, like, it's nothing. It doesn't matter. It goes by more quickly than you can imagine. It made me want to. I went on a little tiny little Kurosawa thing where I just watched more of his movies, just some research on him. It really kind of got me excited about Akira Kurosawa as a filmmaker. But the movie itself, of Seven Samurai, was just, to watch. It's kind of an underdog story of a group of guys that are trying to, they're trying to beat something bigger than themselves, and they're coming together to do it. But as you said, cinematically, the technical aspects of filmmaking is just, it's so far ahead of its time. And I love the influences on, the Westerns, if you will, and vice versa. It's just really, it's a really awesome movie. It's kind of cool the way how efficient he was with extras and, just making, the filmmaking process is pretty cool too. But yeah, that's a really solid pick. It's definitely up there for me as well.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that contributes to the pace is the characters, and that there's so many characters. I forget how many samurai there are, but there's a number of them. Because each of them is so well developed and has so much, you put so much stake in each one, that makes every scene that they're in so much more entertaining and makes the long running time go quickly. But also, once that final battle starts, the stakes are there because everybody on screen is somebody that you care about. And it's just great. So what's your number two?
I wanted to say that it reminds me of another similar film that would be great in like a double pack, like a double feature pack at like Walmart. It'd be Seven Samurai and Three Ninjas.
Right. Yeah. Oh man. Talk about film grammar.
Yeah. That's 10 martial artists in all.
Yeah.
That would be exciting.
That's double.
My number two is more of a kind of a personal attachment. And it's actually, I tell people it's, people ask me what my favorite movie of all time is, which is All the Time. No, it's not. It's not very often. But I say it's a tie between this one and my number one. But really, my number two movie, it's not really a tie. It's number two, and that's Magnolia by Paul Thomas Anderson. It was just one of those situations where I'm really just immersing myself in good movies. Do you know what I mean? I'm seeking out great filmmakers, great movies to watch to kind of broaden my horizons in that regard, to really kind of developing myself and my taste in movies, but I'm trying to see all I can see in order to do that. And Magnolia was one of those movies where I think I hit a breakthrough, so to speak, and just saying, oh, this, I love these kinds of movies. I love this, these kinds of directors. And it was a movie like Magnolia that I saw. I guess I saw it. It came out in 99. I guess I saw it 2 or 3 years later. I was in college, and it's a combination of just having an emotional reaction to it, to all the different storylines. I think I felt something for every single storyline in this, and add to it the really cool idea of many, many characters that are connected in some way, some more strongly than others, but there are connections there. It starts out with a cool little montage of three really unfortunate coincidences, kind of saying, you know, again, basically everything's tied together. And then it goes on this, it's a pretty long movie. It goes on this big web of stories and characters, and you just watch, they're all going through something pretty intense, and you see it unfold. And then you also see how they're all connected. And it doesn't really draw a ton of attention to it, except for the fact that, oh, you see this guy was, oh, he was so-and-so's nurse, and now he's over, oh, okay. But I think Paul Thomas Anderson is definitely one of my favorite filmmakers. I think, and this movie right here really puts him at the top for me. The way he directs all these actors and all these storylines, it's just insane for me. I think you get Julianne Moore, who knows how to dance on that line between, you know, just good acting and just way over the top. I think she's great here. I think she's got some really awesome moments. I love Philip Seymour Hoffman as the nurse. I think John C. Reilly is great. I love how he's a comedic actor, but he's in these really, you know, dark, serious films early on in his career. Philip Baker Hall, he was around for so long. I love his character here, how he's just got such a dark side to him. And he has that, what is that quote that he has? The book says we may be done with the past, but the past ain't done with us.
Right.
And you see his past unfold that with his, you know, horrible things that he had done, and then his daughter, who is affected by that, how her storyline unfolds, and how she's, years later, how she's dealt with that. And I think Henry Gibson, the old actor in that bar, who's obviously has he's putting down, as Thurston Howell, he's putting down William H. Macy, the former whiz kid, but he's also, you know, his eyes are glued to that young strapping bartender. But I think one of the big takeaways from this, in my opinion, being a huge Tom Cruise fan, I think this is Tom Cruise's, this is the toast of his career. This is his best performance. And I think you see Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible and, you know, the great, you know, franchises like Jack Reacher. I'm just kidding. But he's this guy is talented. I think a lot of people, I'm not saying a lot of people don't know that. I think people know that. That's why they like him. But he's really a talented actor. And this performance here proves that. It's just off the wall, this smarmy, sleazy, cocky, motivational speaker, if you want to call it that, the switch is flipped. You see it flipped, and then he goes to visit his dad, and it's just, he just loses it. It's at least three big developments of emotion for him that come off the screen. It's just incredible. That's my number two. I usually say it's tied for number one, but really, I think it belongs in the number two slot because you insisted on doing top three. So there you have it.
Exactly. No cheating. Yeah. Magnolia is a film that I kind of discovered it too. Like, or, you know,
it was right there when I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go crazy about movies.
Yeah.
Obviously this is the, you know, this is that it was around that time. So that was the one I picked up. And yeah, at some point I think it was probably in my top, you know, 25 or 50 over time. As I've gotten older, it has kind of slipped an awful lot just because of there's an emotional tenor that Paul Thomas Anderson strikes in this movie and in some of his other movies that doesn't sit quite well with me. It's borderline histrionic. But then as I get even older than that, I kind of see, well, you know, once you look at the unifying kind of theme of his movies about, you know, broken people, trying to reconcile with a broken world, you know, there's a lot more truth to that, than probably I would have liked to think earlier on in my life. So it's kind of an evolving relationship with Paul Thomas Anderson that I have. But the one thing that nobody can ever take away is, you know, the craft and the filmmaking and obviously the performances, like you mentioned. I mean, you kind of almost wonder if the Tom Cruise stuff is somehow autobiographical in some ways. But the for Tom Cruise, not for Paul Thomas Anderson. But the filmmaking here, it's like he made Boogie Nights, you know, which was extremely accomplished. And then he was like, look, guys, I don't think you were paying attention, you know, and just turned everything up. And I mean, just in that prologue alone, you know, that is just a phenomenally paced and put together sequence. So yeah, Magnolia is a movie that belongs in the discussion, and it's a great pick. And you know, you mentioned that it was a personal pick for you. I mean, all of these are probably very personal to us. But my number two is a similar thing, where it's just this is a movie that it's changed the way I talk. It's changed the way it's changed the way that I watch movies. I don't think I've ever had a bigger emotional reaction to a movie before. And it's The Big Lebowski. And the emotion, of course, is, I guess laughter isn't an emotion. But the greatest physical reaction I've ever had to a movie ever is when me and my brother were watching The Big Lebowski on his couch in his room. And it was the first time either of us had seen it. And there's a moment where the dude is smoking a joint. He sees that he's being followed by a suspicious Volkswagen Bug. He's drinking a beer, so he flicks the joint out the window. The window's rolled up, so the joint bounces off the window, lands in his lap. He starts screaming like a small child, starts pouring the, you know, the trying to put the joint out with the beer, pouring it into his lap. His car, he's got the outside of his car is swerving around, and it swerves and hits this dumpster. The dumpster, like, kicks backwards. The front of the car lifts up from the impact, and then the scene kind of ends, and he finally finds some evidence about who stole his car, Larry Sellers. So it's in that moment, I think both of us were on the ground laughing. It's just, and there's so many moments like that in The Big Lebowski. It's this movie about this guy who has his perfect world, like most great comedies, I think. It's this guy who has his perfect world, and that world is interrupted by circumstances beyond his control. And we have the pleasure of watching this guy whose life is designed to have the minimal amount of conflict and incidents in it. We get to watch this guy react to that. And it's just an amazing performance from Jeff Bridges, and of course it's all tied together nicely by John Goodman's incredible raging performance as Walter Sobchak. It's just a hilarious movie. And then look, if it's not as funny as it is, you just look at the production design, you look at the cinematography, the script, the weird pointless complexity of it all. It's a movie about nothing, where nothing happens, and yet it's no more, it's no less inconsequential than The Big Sleep, and it's such a great ode to film noir, and yeah, The Big Lebowski is a movie that at one point I had like a little like 500 megabyte MP3 player. And I ripped the Big Lebowski audio onto that MP3 player and just drove around listening to the movie. From the dialogue, the music, everything about this movie is just it's incredible. And I have friends where literally we can just have an entire conversation made of nothing but Big Lebowski quotes. And like I said, it's a personal pick. Kind of a life-changing movie for me, and it's my number two of all time.
It's an awesome movie. We were talking about in the other three films that we mentioned how the directors were so in tune with, you know, the story actually, that, you know, some of the technical aspects are very much consistent with that story. As far as like Michael Corleone being in a shadow and stuff like that. And the Coens are some of the best filmmakers right now.
Yep.
And I mean way up there, not like, you know, the top 15. They're at the very top. And it's kind of the same thing with Lebowski. I think I always remember that on the TV in the background is George Bush doing
right.
that speech where he
lying in the
sand. Aggression.
Yeah.
Yeah, this aggression will not stand. And then very soon afterwards, the dude says that to somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's something it's not very obvious. You may not notice it immediately, but it's like, it's so funny because he is who he is, as you said, no conflict. But he's influenced by, you know, stuff he hears subconsciously. He wasn't even paying attention to that, but he heard it and he used it. And you know, he didn't vote for Bush, but he's using that. It's pretty awesome. Stuff like that just gets me giddy for movies.
Yeah.
But,
the way that they use gold bricking, in the parlance of our times, you know, you're right.
Yeah.
First of all, the patter, you know, the rhythm and everything of the dialogue is just incredible. But then, yeah, like you said, the way that, the repetition and the cyclical nature of it all, you know, speaks to, you know, his unwillingness to be changed by anything, at least consciously is great.
Yeah. And you're talking about just kind of the dialogue being just in sync with everyone. And I think it's no more, obvious than when the dude and when you've got and John Goodman and Steve Buscemi all sitting there just talking, and it's really the dude and Walter kind of just they're hashing something out,
right?
And Buscemi's just, you know, Don's just kind of like he's there, but he chimes in. It's perfect, and
he chimes in.
But Goodman's response to Walter, I'm confusing the listener, sorry. It responds to both of them while having two conversations. It's so great. There's nothing else like it. There's no other movie like this. And it's a solid noir. Everybody has their own quirks. Every character is their own thing. Even the nihilist.
The script is
perfect.
David Thewlis is Doc Harrington, the video artist, is one of my favorites.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, wonderful woman.
We're all quite fond of her. Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned Julianne Moore and Philip Seymour Hoffman in Magnolia, and just a year previous, you know, they were highlights of one of the best comedies of all time. So that speaks to their talent.
Yeah, man, what a great movie.
Yeah.
My number one might seem pretty obvious, but I don't care because I really do feel this way. I watched this movie. I really enjoyed this movie when I watched it for the first time. And then I watched the Roger Ebert commentary for this movie. And that set this movie in stone as the number one movie for me of all time. I'm not even sure it's ever going to get usurped. But that's Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
I mean, when you watch it, it's a, well, that's a great movie, great character development. It's the rise and fall of a huge media mogul, and, you know, going through his childhood, mainly his early and late years. And there's no denying this movie, and from, you know, the early 40s is a great, great movie. But then I immediately, I don't know if it was immediately after watching it or the next night, I put it on the Roger Ebert commentary, which is on the most DVDs that you, if you buy Citizen Kane on DVD, don't buy it if it doesn't have the Roger Ebert commentary. But Roger Ebert proceeds to go from the second the movie starts, explaining to the audience all the innovative things that Orson Welles did to make these scenes happen and to get this movie made, and all at the age of, what, 24?
Yep.
Is that right? Early 20s?
Yeah.
Some of the things that Roger Ebert... some of the things that Roger Ebert explained that how he did to get some of these things done is just, it's mind-blowing. And at every scene, you fall in love with this movie more and more. From the opening scene where it's got the, you know, the silhouette of Xanadu at night, but it kind of dissolves into different angles or views of that. Xanadu is his complex, his big, huge castle, and it dissolves into different views of this. But there's one window that's lit in the whole, you know, building, but it stays in the same part of the screen the whole time. No matter which angle you're looking at the house from, somehow that lit window doesn't move. And then the newspaper reel explaining, you know, hey, some background, which is a brilliant way to explain, you know, how this company and this Charles Foster Kane has got to where he is. It shows newsreels, but it's old, like, stock footage that they found in a warehouse and dragged on the concrete to make it look old and then spit it into the, you know, projector. Little tidbits like that, that's just the opening scene. It's all through this. Talking about forced perspective, things looking different. I mean, there are things that look so much more larger than they actually are. And while that's fine and good, but when you see Orson Welles standing really close to the camera, and you see this thing in this pillar in the background, and then when he walks back towards it, you're forced to say, oh, that thing is so much smaller than it looked. You know, there's all these things that are just, and Roger Ebert exposes those to the audience. So that to me is just a great story of the rise and fall of Charles Foster Kane, an imaginary media mogul who's not based on anybody.
Nope, nope.
All right. But it's full, at the age of 24, it's full of innovative filmmaking techniques, and that aren't just to be more efficient to get the movie made, which it definitely is that, but it's cool little Easter eggs that, you know, you have to watch 100 times to get, or you have to have somebody show you. It's just amazing to me. So it's a combination of those two things. Really, I'll be forever grateful to Ebert for putting that thing together. But he only tells me what all went into this movie. And it's all from Orson Welles. And so that's why Citizen Kane is my number one.
Yeah, it's a miracle of a movie, and just you talking to you about it and thinking about it, I feel totally guilty for not having it on this list, let alone every other list that I could possibly come up with. Yeah, it's like you said. I mean, it's every filmmaking trick available to him up at that time, you know, up to that point, and he's using it all in service of character and in story, and in theme, It's fantastic. I mean, it's so, like you said, like every shot is so well considered. It's just a meticulously put together film. The makeup is surprisingly good, especially for the amount of aging that all the characters do. It's a film that's still resonant to this day, in terms of, you know, how we respond to celebrity. And it's a film that, it uses film noir. It's a mystery. It has horror elements. You know, there's a musical number in it. It combines the best of movies, and it's one of the, and of course it's also emotionally engaging. You know, it's like if it was all just a big technical exercise, that'd be one thing, but you know, there's still that, that story that, the character played by Everett Sloan tells about the girl in the white hat, you know, that it was this beautiful woman that he saw, you know, all those years ago, and he still thinks about her like every few days. And it's like, it's one of those like amazingly little human moments that, that somehow sums up the entire film in a strange little way. But you know, it's still a film that's all about people, despite all of these huge technical, machinations that Welles was ever able to pull off. You know, he did not lose sight of the ball. And, Orson Welles is a freak of nature, and this movie is one of the greatest proofs of that. He was the way his brain worked, and the way he was able to put this all together so meticulously without, you know, without computers, without like, you know, seeing if it would work and then going back and doing it that way. You know, now if you shoot something, you throw it in the computer, cut it together, and it's like, let me tweak this and do it this different way. Or that was a complete disaster. Let me come up with something new. But, you know, he basically just watched a bunch of John Ford movies and his brain figured out how to make this movie. And it's mind blowing, and it's a one of a kind movie. And, you know, it's almost one of those things where, well, why do movies exist? You know, why did God let movies exist? Oh, it's maybe it was just so that Citizen Kane could happen.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like everything since then has been like a novelty.
And yeah, I think about what I've accomplished in my life at the age of 32, now almost 33.
Yeah.
I think I have to do the math every time because I don't, whatever. But, and he did this 8 years ago. In my life. And I'm like, what am I doing?
Yeah. It's not fair. Yeah, imagine being a filmmaker and then, I mean, that may be, there may be a deep, dark psychological reason why I don't have this higher, and it may just be just pure, like, well, I won't even ever come close to doing anything like this, you know? And it's like, well, he did it before he was 30, and I'm not under 30 anymore, and that's sad.
And as you said, it's kind of these days with, you know, computers and everything, you know, computers and everything, that explains exactly what I mean.
Right.
But it's almost, can we have another Citizen Kane in this era or in any future era?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I think you can, because all of the stuff that he does it's not only still very possible, obviously, it's more possible, but, and yet we've regressed, you know, and yet like film grammar is, you know, has totally degraded since then. The shots and the editing and the blocking mean so much in Citizen Kane, and yet those elements in so many movies that come out now are totally ignored. You know, we have these movies that are shot entirely in coverage, you know, where it's just wide, you know, wide two shot and reverse shot and boom, there you go. And it becomes an instant classic. And it's like, well, maybe we should, you know, hold the standard a little bit higher. And I mean, you mentioned earlier that the screenplay and the story is the most important part of a film, but I feel like sometimes nowadays that's often all that a film is. And we ignore film grammar, film craft, and the things that shots mean, and the things that editing means. And Steven Soderbergh recently went on a big rant. I forget where it was, but he was just talking about, like, look, there are rules. Like, there are reasons that certain shots work in certain ways, and if you just stick to those rules, then you're gonna be competent. And yet, we have these major motion pictures out there that he was talking about that they just throw it all out the window because I guess they don't feel like trying or they think that it's not as important as it is. And so, Citizen Kane, I think we can do better. I think we can. It's just a matter of I can't personally, obviously. I will never. But we, you know, as a society, as a filmmaking a civilization, I feel like we can do better, and we don't. And I don't know. It's sad, but at the same time, even if we never do, we've still got Citizen Kane.
You know what? I think what's going to happen is that we're going to get just so immersed in this digital age that someday somebody is going to now I'm going to have a Wilson Phillips song stuck on my head the rest of the day.
Well,
pardon me. Someday somebody will regress and do it the hard way and make a Citizen Kane-like movie where when everyone has forgotten all these cool little tricks of the trade that were created or that were mastered by Orson Welles and Citizen Kane, and a long time from now, and then that's going to be the next Citizen Kane, but it's going to be going backwards, and it's just going to be doing Citizen Kane, but not as well. But in the future, that will be more of a masterpiece than Citizen Kane is now.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, that is such a great segue into my number one, which is, which is a Wilson Phillips documentary that I saw on TBS. No, it's a movie that goes back and borrows from, you know, Hollywood classics of all shapes and sizes. It's a movie that puts limitations on itself after the director had a enormous flop before it happened, and the filmmaker decided he was going to make a great throwback movie on time and on budget, and it's, of course, Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark. Which is, it's got a shot that's straight out of Stagecoach, you know, so there's so much classic Hollywood here. There's so much, you know, classic, B movie, Hollywood here and serials, but also it's something entirely new. Obviously, I mean, we're still getting more Indiana Jones movies. And it's such a, It's the perfect movie. Like I said earlier, Citizen Kane may be the reason, you know, to make Citizen Kane may be why we invented cinema. But I think that really, you know, if you're looking at using movies at their full potential, Raiders of the Lost Ark does it. You know, it's just it's motion, it's sound, it's performance, it's empathy, and it's great. And of course, all of it is wrapped up into this strange, counterintuitive ending where this hero basically gives it all up and lets fate or God, I guess, take center stage and kill some Nazis. I think it's a movie that's always worth talking about, you know, and you can pick it apart. You can enjoy it on a completely shallow level, and it works better than any other action movie ever made. And then you can totally pick it apart and say, okay, this shot, you know, means this and this shot goes there and oh, I wonder how they did this and oh, you know, really what is that last shot mean? What does that ending mean, you know, where you strive for this thing that you've been striving for the whole time and then the establishment takes it away and tucks it away. I don't know, I just feel like there's it's such a, in its own special way, it's this very gutsy movie, but because it's so entertaining, it doesn't feel gutsy at all. It just feels like, you know, serving the audience up exactly what they think they want. It's Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's the movie that, you know, if there's nothing else, if there's nothing else to watch, I'll watch it. Or maybe sometimes if there's, you know, it's just a movie that I just put on. I find myself putting on without even thinking about it. You know, it's again, not to keep talking about my own crap, but you know, when I'm making a film, there's a handful of movies that I have to go back to. Jaws is one of them, and Raiders of the Lost Ark is another one, and Citizen Kane probably should be one of them. But it's just a great it's perfect, man. Like there's not a hair out of place, and clearly it's hit a nerve not just with movie fans, but with the culture at large, because you know we're getting more.
Yeah, you talked about serving the audience, but before that, you had mentioned, you know, if Citizen Kane is why God makes movies, then, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you explained your thoughts on that, but I think you kind of went to where I was going to go with that, is if Citizen Kane is why God made movies, then Raiders of the Lost Ark is taking that and making it and maximizing the audience enjoyment. Orson Welles maximized what you can do as a filmmaker to really make a movie and all its technical aspects and the filmmaking process, like just blow it out of the water creativity wise. And Spielberg does that, still technically perfect, but maximizes the audience enjoyment, which I think is definitely more enjoyable than Citizen Kane. And that's what Steven Spielberg is so great at. And Raiders of the Lost Ark is a great movie to end his career on too.
Right, exactly. Yeah, whatever happened to him? It's just the level of imagination that's on display here from every aspect of just the audacity to, you know, make this adventure movie about this old Old Testament thing, but then also, you know, the stunts and the sequences, figuring out how to pull them off and figuring out what all you can put in front of your hero. It's great A to B to C filmmaking. And I don't know, like it's like the end of Sullivan's Travels, you know, where it's like, well, movies can be this grand thing and this big thing, but at the end of the day, you know, if they're not moving an audience, then they're not really doing their job. It kind of goes back to what you're saying about story. But also I think it goes back to what I was saying on in just terms of craft and cinema, that you can turn the sound off on Raiders and know exactly what's going on, because every shot, you know, is doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, I was saying those stunts are still relevant too. They still have that stunt show at MGM/Hollywood Studios every single day. Which is one of the best things about that theme park. I watched this movie very recently, just coincidentally. And it's just, I was just glued to the TV watching this. It was, and I hadn't seen it in quite a while, but it's definitely one that I think you should watch like every year if you can. Because you said, you could turn the sound off and know exactly what's going on, because Spielberg is so in tune with making the visually telling the story along with, you know, the dialogue. The audacity to make that, I mean, this is about a biblical thing, and I forget that, maybe others do too, because it doesn't really push any buttons or doesn't really kind of make any odd statements or proclamations on anything like that. It's just, this is a legendary object that the Nazis want to find, and it's really awesome. If a movie is about Nazi Germany, or, you know, that World War II era with the Holocaust, or, you know, kind of Nazi Germany or anything like that, I'm automatically interested in a movie that's about that. But then when you just turn it up, you know, the enjoyment, like Spielberg always does, always did, then it's just right up my alley. I'm gonna love a movie like that. And yeah, every second of this movie is the opening sequence. Before you even get to, you know, running from a rolling huge boulder, it's fascinating, because where are they going? What are they doing? You know.
Yeah.
And he's got these signature shots that you can see all the way through the end of his career that ended with Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that whole opening sequence, the way that he's introduced through, you know, close-ups and inserts and the way the light, you know, plays and all that, even the dissolve from the Paramount logo to the mount, it's just all so awesome, you know, and it's it's therapeutic, like you're talking. Like it's a movie where God melts Nazis. You know, it's so therapeutic. It's finally seeing justice being done, you know, on the big screen. And I got to see it in the theater a few years ago. They did like a digital run of it. It may have been in 2011 for its 30-year anniversary, and it was just such a joy to watch. I think the easiest way I can describe Raiders is to say that just think of the things that you like about a bunch of other movies. Every single one of those things is in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I feel like that's a good place to leave it. Well, do you have any, do you want to wrap it up with anything? You want to throw out a couple of where, I mean, I hate to open this Pandora's box, open this ark and see nothing but sand and then let my face be melted by all of your picks. But do you have any that you were just like, man, you almost had in that top three?
And it wasn't the ark they found. It wasn't the ark they found. They actually dug up Pandora's box. That's what told everyone.
So it's not Pandora at all. Yeah.
I like your list a lot. I want to say I appreciate how personal it is, and I like that there was not a duplicate on either of our lists. So you've got six of the greatest movies ever made right here. If we're going. If I'm going to any movie that barely missed the cut, a Stanley Kubrick movie definitely should be represented in some of my favorite movies. I think A Clockwork Orange is probably the movie that I would have chosen to represent that. The Searchers is another movie that's personal to me. It was kind of cool that I realized after I'd seen it and enjoyed it that it was actually a highly regarded film. That was some validation for me that I am kind of proud of. It was a really enjoyable movie. Before I was really at the beginning of my diving into the movie process, but those two movies, E.T. I love that one, and it's just so hard. There's three other ones: E.T., what did I say? The Searchers, and A Clockwork Orange. To Kill a Mockingbird, I'll throw that one in there. There's four.
Okay. Yeah. It's tough. My whole top ten always changes. But I mean, just off the top of my head, Rear Window, Die Hard, and Unforgiven are probably would probably be, you know, floating around there somewhere too. Oh, Pinocchio is just representing all of animation is one that I go to so often and just always find more to enjoy. That's the Disney one, not the Jonathan Taylor Thomas one.
Okay.
Sorry.
That was my next question.
Yes. Well, good. Yeah, all of these are really great movies, and obviously we recommend them. So let's see what the other film nerds have to say about their top three favorite movies of all time.
Hey, Ben, how's it going?
Good, Graham. What's up?
Well, it's a very exciting time and milestone for everybody involved with the FNU Film Nerds Unlimited podcast. This is our 100th episode, which is amazing. It's been really fun so far, and I appreciate everything you guys have done, and it's just hopefully it continues to grow. We can get the word out, but we're obviously all having a great time. We've done it 100 times between all of us, plus Franco, and who contributes semi-regularly, and it's just a great group, and I look forward to doing even more.
Yeah, this is amazing that we've come this far already in the young history of FNU, and it's been a blast, and I've enjoyed it, but I promise you I've been dreading this episode due to the topic that we're about to discuss.
Yeah, so Ben Stark's idea was to talk about our three top favorite films of all time. And obviously, we're all big film fans, and it's tough to do that. It's really difficult to narrow it down to three. You know, I mean, it's tough to make a top 10 list, let alone three, let alone one. So I'll go ahead and I don't know if you want to start it off and do we want to go 3-1 and do it that way?
Yeah, let's go 3-1 and why don't we each preface how we came to these decisions?
Yeah, okay. Well, I want to start off by sort of saying, and I'm sorry if this is breaking the rules, but we'll just make them up as we go along. But I want to start by prefacing this with sort of an outlier, like a number 4 for me that just very recently has sort of entered this pantheon for me. And that's Hayao Miyazaki's Porco Rosso, which to me for the last like year and a half has just become such a favorite go-to piece of cinema for me. It's animated. It's from 1992. There's an English dubbed version with a lot of American actors and movie stars, but I prefer the original Japanese version. And to me, this film has just become so special to me. So I almost flirted with making that the number 3. But then the top three, is you know, it's basically been the same 3 movies for a long time, long period of my life. So I wanted to stick with that. Before I get to number 3, is there an outlier type pick for you?
Well, I mean, I guess I better mention sort of the rest of the top 10 later after I go over the 3. Since college, I guess, I've kind of had a stock top 3
mm-hmm.
for years, and it hasn't changed. And honestly, I'm kind of ready for a fresh start. I think since mm-hmm. college, my tastes have matured a lot, and I've tried to evolve as a film goer, and I try to be as honest as possible with myself and others, you know, especially as the years go on. And you know, a lot of my I love every single movie in my top 10, my top 15, whatever. I love them mm-hmm. dearly, but I think it's important to me personally that I'm just brutally honest with our listeners and you and myself and our fellow film nerds. Because, you know, you can list your top movies that you either love, top movies that you think are the best movies, top movies that you think make you sound smart as a moviegoer that you want people to hear as your top movies. People have a variety of different ways that they might come up with this list. But this time today, I'm going to choose honesty and I'm just going to be myself.
Okay, well, since you've got the sort of the hot hand right now, why don't you get started with your first pick?
I'm going to stick with one of my old top 3, and because he's just one of my favorite filmmakers whose body of work is just so immense and so colorful and vibrant, it's hard to pick just one. So I'm going to stick with the one that most people regard as his best and is sort of representative of his entire career in filmography and really sort of changed the game the way movies, let alone romantic comedies, were made from that point on. My number 3 is Annie Hall from Woody Allen. And it's a movie that feels as fresh as ever since it was made back in the late 70s. And it's just an unbelievable step for filmmaking and creativity, American filmmaking specifically, and I just can't believe that something as rich and funny and different came out at that point in the late set. This movie feels like it could come out in 2016 and it made me laugh as hard as it ever has, and it's touching, it's really just, it's creative just in terms of the way it portrays a modern relationship, and it's just bitingly funny. I mean, it's as funny as anything Woody Allen has ever made or written or directed. It's got an interesting backstory in that it was meant to be a different kind of movie completely, and in the editing room turned out to become one of the greatest comedies ever made, and for me, one of the greatest films ever made. And again, I can pick a few different Woody Allen movies as what my favorite Woody Allen movie might be that day. And so that day, that movie would be perhaps in my top three of all time. So it's just kind of like a rotating Woody Allen movie, but I'll play it safe and go Annie Hall because it is one of the greatest movies ever made and it deserves the spot.
Do you remember the first time you ever saw that movie?
I think the first time I ever saw it, I was going to say it was like at our grandmother's house.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't be sure. It may have been at ours because, I mean, we've watched so many movies and Woody Allen movies at so many different houses. But no, I can't put my finger on when exactly it was. I think it was probably when I was in middle or early high school.
Yeah, I think it was, because I'm pretty sure it was the first time I'd seen it too. And I think we rented it from a movie gallery and watched it, like you said, at our grandmother's house. And I feel like I must have been like 16. And you know, 16, and you, that would have made you like 13 at the time. And, you know, Dad recommended we watch it. And I think we'd seen some of the early funny ones at that point. But you know, it definitely resonated with me as a 16-year-old, and I had no idea what the movie was about. You know, I had no idea at the time, you know, what these types of issues these characters were dealing with, but yet it resonated with me. And just sort of changed the way I viewed the possibilities of modern romantic relationships. And like you said, it is hilarious. Throughout, it is just from the very beginning, it is so funny, but yet also sad and moving and bittersweet. And it is, I mean, it just sort of, and it's funny because that's sort of the first quote unquote serious film that Woody Allen made, you know, after he had this run of goofy slapstick comedies. And he's admitted that he had no idea what he was doing. And he depended on Gordon Willis, the director of photography, who was just coming off of the Godfather movies, to sort of steer the ship. And he's been very outspoken about that. But this film, you know, certainly established his sort of aesthetic that he stuck with in a lot of ways moving forward. Again, he stuck, Gordon Willis was his DP for his next like four or five movies before he entered a new era in the 80s. But it's a great pick, absolutely. And you know, it's always difficult to think of like what to name your favorite Woody Allen movie. But it's always, you know, a safe bet and pick to go back to this one, which really did start it all. So for me, my number three is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And it, like you said, with Woody Allen, there's it's really hard to narrow down one movie to sort of represent a specific filmmaker has meant to you. And you know, when they have such a diverse and large body of work. And Spielberg has so many masterpieces, but this one has sort of always been sort of the one that I keep going back to, the one that has, you know, the biggest impact, the one that's it's so entertaining every time on so many levels, technically, in terms of the story, the performances. I mean, Richard Dreyfuss should have won an Oscar for this. I still have yet to see The Goodbye Girl, but he's just unbelievable in this film. The music, Truffaut, his character, Bob Balaban, their characters, it's very special to me. And he, in this film, you know, when people talk about early Spielberg and, you know, sort of capturing a time and place in like middle-class suburban America, I feel like it doesn't get any more authentic than it does here. And he does, he also nails it in E.T. And in Poltergeist, to an extent, a movie he produced after this one. I feel like this is where he sort of laid the framework for that feeling that it's been very, that people have tried to copy and recreate, but it's obviously very difficult because there's so few examples of succeeding at that. But for me, this film is just the purest Spielberg film in that regard, in terms of the way that it sort of creates something that we can all identify with. And you know, obviously it came out just a few years before I was born, but not only recreating that aspect of realism, but then also, you know, showing you what's possible with imagination and the way that the story is rolled out, the suspense. It's just an epic, truly special film.
Yeah, you know, that's actually my number four all time, and it's my favorite Spielberg movie too. And it's interesting now, looking back, how Close Encounters, which is just this ultimate celebration of like the awe that cinema really inspires in moviegoers, the fact that it kind of gets lost in the fold when people look back on Steven Spielberg's career, even his earlier career. I mean, people are quicker to point out Jaws and Raiders of the Lost Ark and even E.T., and that's totally fair, but Close Encounters is as good as all of those movies, and for me, even better, and it's just such a rich experience. It's what movie going is really all about, and it's something you can just sit and marvel at. And there's so much mystery throughout the movie as to what's this all about, what's going to happen. And the payoff is just so grand and thorough and really truly majestic. It's meant to be seen on the big screen, but it can have that effect on you no matter how you watch it, like you said, with the music and the visuals. And this movie came on Turner Classic Movies just a couple of weeks ago, and it was right when the big climactic Close Encounter was about to happen under Devil's Tower, and I kind of had to check the time and make sure I had nowhere to be, right? Because I was stuck. I wanted to watch this in HD. It had been forever since I'd seen it in that format. It had been a while since I'd watched the movie, but I just sat there and just marveled at the screen the way that I hope that the actors and the crew kind of marveled at what they, along with their leader there, Steven Spielberg, was doing, because it's one of the most special movies ever made, and I hope people don't forget it.
Absolutely, and I remember just a quick memory. I remember before I'd ever seen it, I didn't see this movie all the way through, I don't think, in one sitting until I was at least 12 or 13. I had not seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind before I saw Jurassic Park, just to kind of put it in perspective. It came later. But I remember Mom and Dad talking about it, you know, referencing it at times. And, you know, of course, they said it was filmed in Alabama. And it's this alien movie. And I might have caught a glimpse of it on TV every so often. But I remember for a long time just thinking that it was called Close Encounters, and that's it, which is probably what the name of the reboot will be called. But I remember Mom saying, no, it's actually got a bigger – it's called Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I was like – and I remember being very young, you know, under it, like – 10 or under, and thinking, that's a horrible title for a movie. Like, that's way too long. I've never heard of a movie with that many words in the title, you know? And then I kind of thought to myself, okay, I'll wait on that. Cause that title is just kind of, it's just kind of ridiculous. I'm going to wait until I'm ready to process that. I'll stick with, you know, cartoons for now. But I just remember having that sort of weird reaction to just the title being so long. It is kind of a long title, you know, especially for Spielberg after the previous movie is just called Jaws. and then, you know, his next one is like, has all kinds of articles and, you know, it's such a weird title. It's interesting that he's like, okay, I'm sure everybody was thinking, what's he going to follow up Jaws with? And he's like, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. What? But it worked. It was a massive hit. And it you know, is my favorite of his films, and it led to Raiders of the Lost Ark and then E.T. And so that's just definitely the golden age of Spielberg. So I'm glad we both agree.
Yep. My number two is rooted in one of my favorite theatrical experiences ever. And it was when I was in the sixth grade and our family took a trip. I think it was a spring break trip to New Orleans. And we went to the New Orleans, I guess what you could call their art house theater, Canal Place, which, you know, still gets some art house titles these days. But for whatever reason, when I was 12 years old or so, 11 or 12 years old, in spring of 1996, I was allowed to see Joel and Ethan Coen's Fargo. And it's just, I'll never forget seeing that movie in a theater and just being as blown away as I was that a movie could be so funny and so thrilling and suspenseful at the same time, and violent for that matter at the same time. And ever since then, whenever Fargo is on, whether I choose to watch it, whether I put the DVD in, or if it's just on TV, I'm just filled with that same sense of joy whenever it comes on. Every single line works for me. Every single character and performance is just, I'm over the moon about. I think it's the most beautifully and perfectly cast movie maybe ever. And the story itself is just so ridiculous and fun. And it's, again, you talk about the quintessential experience of these filmmakers. What movie represents their style, their filmography, their career? Fargo does that for me, for the Coen brothers. It's one of the richest film experiences ever. I was filled again with joy that It won Oscars, a movie that was released so early in the year. The Coen brothers were on my list of favorite filmmakers back when we did episode 50. They're in my top three filmmakers, too. And one big reason is because they were probably the first filmmakers whose work I watched and I realized this is someone's style. This is the work of an individual. And in this case, it's two individuals whose style is immediately recognizable and whose signature you can see from beginning to end, and that is never more the case than what you see in Fargo. And it's a new addition to my top three here, but again, if I'm being honest with myself, it's one of my favorite movies. I'll never get tired of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfect. And I remember that time in New Orleans very well. Because, you know, back in that time, it was 96, our parents were very careful about what they let us see and not see, you know, and that we got denied on so many movies that we were thirsty to see. And I can say safely that at that time, when I was 13 and you must have been 10 or 11, that we had a real bloodlust. You know, we wanted into horror, but it was just something about, like, smartly choreographed action and death. And a lot of this is thanks to, you know, Tarantino and what he and sort of ushered in, and Martin Scorsese. But we wanted to see those types of films. And I don't think Mom and Dad really knew what they were getting, you know, what we were getting into there. I think if Dad would have known the extent of the violence, he might not have let us see it. But, you know, he knew that the Coen brothers were weird because he was familiar with Barton Fink and Blood Simple and Raising Arizona. So he knew they had, like, a dark sense of humor. And, you know, the poster for this movie, which appeared at the Fox, I don't even think Fargo ever even made it to the Fox in Tuscaloosa. But the poster showed a person, a dead man, you know, somebody lying face down in the snow. Regardless, he let us go with our aunt Cynthia, who was much more liberal when it came to, you know, what, you know, movies her kids got to see and whatnot. And we saw it, and it satisfied our bloodlust, that's for sure.
They were careful about what we saw. They were good parents in that, you know, they weren't going to send their kids to watch just anything. But if we're being honest here, we saw a lot more than some kids in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Mm-hmm. I mean, our first R-rated movie was Terminator 2. I was 6 years old. You know, you were 8 or 9 years old. So I don't think many children can say the same thing about the first R-rated movie they saw. They probably waited until they were 16 or 17 before they were allowed to go see something like that at the theater. But, yeah, you know, Mom and Dad knew movies more, you know, they paid a little closer attention, I think, than a lot of other parents. So I think they probably had an idea of what Fargo could be, but I think, you know, 6 years after I had seen my first R-rated movie at the theater, I guess they had decided that we had matured to a point where, yeah, sure, let them go see Fargo if they're seeing all this other stuff. And it turned out okay so far.
Yeah, as an 11-year-old, you'd matured to that point, right? I think that they just missed this one, is what happened, honestly.
Yeah, well, when that foot's going into the wood chipper, you know, and there's blood just spewing out all over the white snow, then it's, I'm sure our Aunt Cynthia probably thought, why in God's name did they let me take their kids to see this movie? But look, it happened, and we're okay.
We'll do a whole podcast about Aunt Cynthia at some point and everything that she allowed us, God bless her, to experience well before we were supposed to, you know, thanks to her HBO and Showtime subscription. And liberal attitude towards what we're allowed to rent at the video store. but great pick. My number two is another film that Steven Spielberg is associated with, and that's Back to the Future. I've probably seen this film more times than any other movie I've seen in my life. And it's like a, you know, how people read the same book over and over and listen to the same song over and over again. That movie has that same impact on me, where I can watch it over and over and over again, and it gets better and better. It feels like it's a part of my psychological makeup at this point. And, you know, the thing is, it's got so many sort of classic aspects of story the hero, the villain, the girl, the objective, et cetera. But then it just, it twists everything around. It's like the girl is the hero's mother in this case. And, you know, you get all this insane technology and all these complicated paradoxes that the characters are dealing with. And it's just a completely original work. You know, it's, there's nothing like it. There had been nothing like it at the time, in terms of storytelling and, you know, incorporation of the technology that you see in the film. And then it led to just this wonderful, beautiful, subsequent two entries in the series that I felt it's just one of the most perfect film trilogies of all time. And it all started with this movie, which is my favorite of the three. With so many great performances, what a great score, one of the great scores of all time. Just everything about this movie is iconic. And for me, it's just meant so much.
Yeah, that's a great pick. And Back to the Future, for my money, might have the best just top to bottom script in movie history. And it's just so rich and quotable and exciting. And it really is electrifying filmmaking on the part of Robert Zemeckis, and it really blew me away and still does to this day. It flies by whenever I watch it, and yeah, it has all the makings of a great movie, and they really followed through on it in creating one of the great film heroes of all time, and Marty McFly, and villains, like you said, and Biff Tannen. Thomas F. Wilson is so great in that role, and all of those roles he plays throughout that trilogy. It's wonderful. And again, I mean, I hate to use the cliche of it's what movies are all about, but Back to the Future and movies are just synonymous, and I love it. And I love that whole trilogy, but you're right. The best one is the first one. It's where it all started and the mythology that it created and all of the wacky places that movie and the other movies go from that point on is just truly amazing and just the wackiest and best kind of movie making there is.
And just to keep getting nostalgic, the way that I was able to see this movie so many times was I was once lucky enough, and I guess like 1991 or 92, our grandmother let me order one of those Columbia House, you know, eight movies for 1 cent specials. And this was one of them that I got, one of the VHSs. And I think it should still be in the house somewhere, but the tape always remained sturdy and reliable. And had it for years, and that was how I was able to experience it over and over again. So,
do you remember the other Columbia House movies?
Yeah, a few. I don't know if I can get all of them right, but Terminator 2 was on there. The Empire Strikes Back. Michael Jordan, Come Fly With Me, I believe, was one of them in that group. Am I missing anything? I'm trying to. I think that's all I can really remember.
There wasn't an Indiana Jones movie in there, was there? Like Raiders of the Lost Ark or something?
Maybe Raiders of the Lost. I'm not sure. I can't remember. Those are the ones that I can clearly remember, though.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a great pick. So my number one here is again, this is all about being honest with myself, being honest with you. I think you'll understand this a little more than other people will, but this is just a movie that clicked with me immediately. I have no choice but to still think it's great. It worked on me as a child, and at that point it had a stranglehold on me that will last forever, you know, until the end of time. And it taught me so much about storytelling, about good versus evil, heroes and villains. And it was just the coolest thing I had ever seen when I was a kid, and it's still the coolest thing I've ever seen. This is a nostalgic pick, a subjective pick, but this would not be an honest list or an honest pick if I didn't talk about Transformers the movie.
Yes, I knew it. I knew it.
From 1986, directed by Nelson Chin. And I just, again, like, I'd be lying.
I know.
My favorite movie of all time. And look, there have been others in the past where I've been like, no, this is my favorite movie. No, this is. And again, we get to that thing where it's like, we don't want to be thought of a certain way by, you know, other
mm-hmm.
people and
mm-hmm.
other serious film goers. But
mm-hmm.
look, it's better to be honest and to praise mm-hmm. and celebrate what you love, whether
mm-hmm.
it's something that you know, stuck with you as a kid, you know, sometimes you grow out of things. And there are plenty of movies and music and shows and things that I've grown out of, but not Transformers the movie. And for whatever reason, it's just stuck with me. And, you know, people will say, no, this is a toy commercial like the Michael Bay movies are today and the Michael Bay series is today. It's just a big Hasbro commercial. Right. Maybe that's true, but, you know, back in the mid-'80s, they had an opportunity to just make a feature-length toy commercial, and maybe that's all the company and the studio wanted. But I think that Milton Shin and company decided they had an opportunity here, and they were going to make something different and memorable and fun and dramatic and tragic. And I think that what struck me so much about this movie is the risks that it really took in terms of manipulating the childhoods of so many, in that to introduce this new line of toys that they were making, the manner in which they did that was they killed off the first wave of Transformers toys, including so many children's hero, Optimus Prime, and they did it in such operatic fashion in this movie, it just deeply affected me as a kid. And I think that it's just a great piece of storytelling and filmmaking, and it's done in such a rich, nuanced way. And you can, you know, people can laugh at this and people can dismiss it, but again, it worked on me as a kid, and I watch it today, and I look for the moment in which it's supposed to get dumb, right? And it's supposed to not work for me as an adult, but I don't know if it's just nostalgia at work, but it still works for me. And to see all of these new characters like Hot Rod and Ultra Magnus and Galvatron, and the fact that they're all played by these big stars like Leonard Nimoy and Judd Nelson, big star at the time, I should say. And it happens to be the last movie that Orson Welles, the great Orson Welles, ever acted in. He plays Unicron, again, this planet-eating transformer, this new character to this universe. And that unto itself is an amazing little tidbit about this movie. But I love the dialogue. I love the beautiful animation here. I'm sorry. I make no apologies. Transformers the movie, if I'm being honest with the world here, it's my favorite movie ever.
That's a great pick, and I know that you're being as absolutely truthful and honest as, you know, as possible. And I know it. I know how much you love it. I love it. I still do. I actually owe myself a viewing. But this really was so important to us as just something that is just guaranteed to blow our minds every time we watch it. And the thing is, it holds up. You know, sometimes you watch things that you might have seen as a kid, and you go back and look at it, and it's like, why was I into that? Like certain Saturday morning cartoons, and you're just like, okay, yeah, I can see why as a kid I really liked it, but now it just doesn't really work. This has the exact same impact on me when I see it, and I absolutely agree with you 100%. That, you know, while it was an important aspect of our childhoods, that it still resonates, and it still is incredible. One of the best, one of my favorite animated films ever. And like everything you said about the storytelling and the impact of the death of Optimus Prime and the new heroes rising, and how you think it's supposed to be Ultra Magnus and he's the one been ordained, but that's not what's meant to happen. And you see Hot Rod, the other character, rise up. I mean, it's truly epic. You know, the story is just amazing. And they, you know, people think it's garbage, but these are the same people that brush off so many other great movies for their own personal reasons. And it's an amazing pick. And I know that I know that what it means to you, and I think it's a great pick, and I know that you are being honest, and I hope people can go back and revisit it based on this. You know, you calling this film your favorite of all time, and give it another chance and try and see the glory of what this movie is.
Yeah, and look, you know, even if those people give it that shot and they don't understand it, look, I probably can't really explain explain it. Again, I think that we all have these movies and shows and this music that will forever stick with us just because it caught us at the right time, maybe. And maybe that's the case with Transformers the movie with me. It's like I see my toys up on the screen. How cool is that? But I think it goes a lot deeper. Again, I buy into the story. I love the animation. I love the soundtrack by Vince DiCola. Songs from Stan Bush. It's an incredible rock soundtrack. And just the characters and the way they evolve and develop and the way the story unfolds. I mean, it probably borrows from a lot of stories that we've seen in films in the past. But I don't know. It's the right. It feels right now.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Congratulations. Thank you for saying what needed to be said. Okay, and now I'm gonna go with my number one of all time, Barry Lyndon by Stanley Kubrick. I saw this film when I was 21 for the first time, and you know, it is of Stanley Kubrick's sort of like post-Spartacus era. It's the least known, least celebrated of his films, even though it definitely is in some circles, you know, revered for a lot of different reasons. And it won 5 Oscars, all in technical categories. But, you know, it's not doesn't get the attention and cult-like following of a Clockwork Orange or 2001 or The Shining. It's weird. It's sort of like an outlier in his filmography, you know, to people that sort of just generally know Stanley Kubrick. A lot of people, you know, name those movies I just mentioned, but then they're like, huh, Barry Lyndon? No, I never saw that. And for me, the reason it's so special to me is because, okay, just the story itself, it's the story of this guy just was born into the world under circumstances that he didn't, you know, when compared to to other people, he doesn't have the most favorable circumstances. And then it just follows him as he sort of rises in society, but because of certain aspects of his character, even though he's afforded all these amazing opportunities that were made by him in many ways, it all comes crashing down because of these negative aspects of his character. So it's a true tragedy about humanity. About how people can, even when they're given these amazing gifts, they squander them for you know, reasons having to do with gluttony or selfishness, and laziness. And it's an amazing story about a man. And so the story itself, you take that, but then what makes it so special is the world that Stanley Kubrick created. There's nothing like this film. I mean, when you watch it, you are transported to another time and place. The cinematography, which won an Oscar, is unlike anything that's ever been, you know, put on film. You know, NASA helped Stanley Kubrick create, you know, the equipment that they needed to shoot with no other light source than candlelight. So it's amazing that they really did use space age technology to recreate a period of time that was the 18th century. I watched this recently. I own it on DVD, but it came on Turner Classic Movies. It's still perfect. It affects me emotionally many times. It's hilarious. So many funny moments in the film. The action is great. And it's a story about growing up, and it's a story. It's a cautionary tale. Also about how you think you can rise so high and you can quickly fall. You know, it's a long film. It's like, it's 3 hours, but it earns every single second. And I hope more and more people give it a chance and, you know, step into this world that Kubrick created.
Yeah. What a great pick. You know, I've only seen Barry Lyndon one time. I think I saw it when I was in high school, maybe like late high school, when you got very into it. You know, I wanted to watch it too, see what it was all about. I was still learning about Stanley Kubrick, and you're exactly right. It's a really rich experience, and it's one I really need to watch again soon. I own it, and I look forward to watching it again because, I mean, the technical mastery on display is amazing. I mean, if nothing else, even if you dislike the story for whatever reason, specifically in Barry Lyndon's case, there's no reason you shouldn't appreciate every single thing that goes into every single frame of a Stanley Kubrick movie. I mean, this guy makes every frame count like no other, and it's always serving the story. So in that regard, you should enjoy the story at hand. So, yeah, I mean, he's a master, and this is a great example of that. You're right in that it's an underrated Kubrick movie. In the way that, to me, Close Encounters is an underrated Spielberg movie, the same is true for Barry Lyndon, as it gets lost as people list Clockwork Orange in 2001 and all these other great movies of his. And that's probably not fair, and it's good that you're celebrating it in the way that you are, because if it forces one person to go out there and watch Barry Lyndon for the first time or to revisit it, then that's a good thing.
Yeah, and you know, I mentioned that I watched it on Turner Classic Movies, and they showed it on this in this aspect ratio that was like it filled up my entire like 16:9 flat screen, and I don't think that's correct. And there's different versions out there that I've seen. I feel like the true aspect ratio is 1:66:1, which isn't, you know, it's a little more of a square than 1:85:1, your typical sort of 16:9. But some DVD versions, and even I think the Blu-ray versions, stretch it out to fill the screen. I'm confused because it seemed like the Turner Classic Movies version did that, and the DVD version, which I thought was the actual aspect ratio, appears to maintain that 1:66:1. So if you're going to see it and you never have, try and find a version that preserves the original aspect ratio and doesn't stretch it to fill your flat screen, because, you know, Kubrick chose to work in this more boxy, squared off aspect ratio. So definitely try and see it, with the correct technical specs, if you are going to seek it out and haven't seen it, or if you've seen it with the stretched out version, try and find it in the original aspect ratio. All right, Ben, so that was fun to do that, but you said you wanted to talk about some of the movies on your top 10 list. So why don't you take that away?
Yeah, so the top three that I had gone with for like the past 10 years or so were Annie Hall, The Graduate, and what I had considered my favorite movie for a long time, Reservoir Dogs, a movie that it was probably my freshman year of college. I watched over and over and over when it got a new release on DVD, and that's about right for a freshman in college to really embrace that movie the way that I did. And look, I still love it. It's a masterpiece. I still think it's Tarantino's best movie, but that's sort of a question I keep asking myself. What is my favorite Tarantino movie? Is it this or is it that? And I think that if I'm struggling to answer that question with Reservoir Dogs in the mix there, then I don't think I can give it the top spot at that point. So I'm going to, you know, keep it in the top 10. It's again, a representative of his filmography, but that's the reason that it's kind of fallen out of, not fallen out of favor, but fallen out of the top spot for now.
Yeah.
So that may change soon. And The Graduate still holds up to me. It was you know, influential, and it's just such a wonderful movie, and it belongs there.
Yeah.
You heard Annie Hall and other movies that have sort of rounded out this top 10. These are just my favorite movies. I've got the picks where it's like the older movies that make me sound smart. These are legit some of my favorite movies. 12 Angry Men is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
All the President's Men is up there and mm-hmm. close to being in this top three today. Citizen Kane is obviously as good as advertised. Double Indemnity is my favorite. Billy Wilder and one of my favorite movies of all time. And some others. Rushmore is a really important movie to me. And some on the outside looking in, Dazed and Confused is so fun. It's a movie I can probably quote from beginning to end. It's to me Richard Linklater's best movie. Steven Soderbergh's Traffic is my favorite of his. He's one of my all-time favorite directors. And Raising Arizona, another Coen movie that I love so much. And those are that's probably does it. If I forget something, I'll mention it. But are there any for you to? You mentioned Porca Rosa, but are there any for you that are on the outside looking in this talk?
Citizen Kane. Also, I agree. It's just unreal. It's so entertaining. You know, and obviously, my inclination is to say it's so crazy that what they were able to do in 1941, but you know, then people might say, oh, you're just giving it, you know, you're just putting it in that context, and that's why it's so high up on the list. No, it's still one of the most entertaining movies ever made. 2001, A Space Odyssey, Lawrence of Arabia, Reservoir Dogs, Glory, which I watched recently, and that was one of the movies in the Columbia House bundle, for sure, was Glory. So Glory, definitely. Two comedies from 1980 are in my list of favorites of all time, Caddyshack and the Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers didn't get on the list until recently when I watched it a couple of times over the last year or so. And it is just an unbelievable achievement of imagination and fun. And just go check it out again. I think it definitely deserves to be on the list. Caddyshack just gives me so much joy. There's no film like it. Rear Window. Then, you know, I can get a few foreign films that are on my list are Akira Kurosawa's Throne of Blood, his retelling of Macbeth. A short film by Eric Rohmer called The Bakery Girl of Monceau, which I saw in Jeremy Butler's French film class, which I just love. And then another film that he showed in that class, which is a musical, French musical from 1931 called Le Million, about the million, about a lottery ticket that everybody's trying to get their hands on. It's so good. That's on Criterion. I believe that's on Hulu. And then Casablanca, of course, is on the list. Watched that recently. It just gets better and better every time. I feel like Rick's Cafe is just one of the greatest sets ever built, and most unique worlds ever created in cinema. And that movie just gets better every time. And then finally, last but not least, a documentary from 1999 called The Making of 1941. But Transformers, the movie, is definitely on mine too. You know, we are like film nerds, you know, at times we do get removed from what truly are rosebuds, as it were, the things that truly inspired us and, you know, made us love movies and movies that have given us the most joy. And Transformers the movie is absolutely on that list. There are beats from that movie that I just carry around with me in my DNA. And, you know, I still say things, like when I'm driving or someone's in my way, I say, out of the way, hot rod. just things that, you know, things that are just in my brain that will be forever. So, I think that definitely you won this podcast with that pick, and it's true and real and authentic. So I applaud you for that. So this has been really fun, and I can't wait to do the next 100 FNU podcasts.
Yeah, congrats.
Matt, it's time. It's time for you to pick the only three movies that have ever and will ever existed, and we're going to hold you to this for the rest of eternity.
Yeah. No, I was actually in the audition recording for this. I pointed out to Craig that, like, I sort of had to make them up right before I did it, because I feel like my top three evolves so often, and on any given day it might be different. But And, you know, I used to have, when I was younger, I had a pretty firm top three that I stuck to for a long time. And I still think they're great movies, but I think just over time, other movies have come to mean more to me. And these three here, it's a very fluid, group of movies, I would say, in general. But these three, I feel like I would go with right now. So just as of this recording.
Okay. Well, let's start at the bottom, I guess. The worst of these. What's your number three?
The worst. Yeah. So
I'm going for this spot with a I knew I wanted to have a Woody Allen movie in here because he is my favorite filmmaker. And I think this movie I've chosen more as a representative of a category of movies he's made that really mean a lot to me and have had a huge impact on me. And so the movie I'm picking is Crimes and Misdemeanors. There are other movies that, you know, on a given day I could watch from Woody Allen and really love and have strong feelings about, but I feel like the type of Woody Allen movie I like the most are the movies where he explores ideas of kind of the nature of the universe and humanity and morality and, you know, what it means to be a person, you know, trying to make decisions, and what, you know, what constitutes good or bad as a human. I feel like this movie does an extremely subtle and, you know, nuanced job of trying to figure out what that all means. It definitely has a perspective and a point of view, but I don't think that you have to share the perspective of the characters in this movie. I think you can look at them and make your own judgments about those kinds of people, but it still shows you, I think, there are a lot of people in the world who believe what those characters believe, you know, that basically good and evil are all just about what you can put up with, you know, what you can go to sleep at night after doing. And, you know, it's always been a very fascinating question to me, and a very interesting topic that he's explored in a lot of movies, but I don't feel like he ever did it as well in the other movies as he did it in Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I feel like we've talked about this before, but I feel like Crimes and Misdemeanors is, you know, like, it's like a highlight reel. You know, it's everything that you could possibly get in a Woody Allen movie in one movie. You know, it's funny, it's got the whole Woody Allen character that carries his subplot, but then it also has, like, thriller elements and drama elements and existential elements, like you mentioned. So, yeah, I think if you're going to pick a Woody Allen movie, this one kind of represents so many of them.
Yeah, and I think it also works to have that comedic element in that movie, too, because it is both a scary and tragic thing to know that there are, you know, people in the world for whom morality is an obstacle to be overcome. But it also can be funny because it can be exercised in kind of smaller, less tragic ways. That impacts things like our ego and our social relationships and stuff. It's something that I think about a lot, and I think it changed the way that I sort of view other people. It made other people in my life perhaps make more sense to me at times. So it's that personal meaning, I think.
Excellent. All right.
So yeah.
Number two
for me is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is just a very formative movie for me. When I was in high school, that was when I was first really kind of soaking in cinema and trying to, you know, educate myself and watch stuff that came on Turner Classic and go to Blockbuster and rent all of the, you know, the so-called classics and run down the AFI list. And I had seen quite a few Westerns by the time I came to that one. And most of them were older, you know, it was John Ford stuff, and even older movies too, like I think Stagecoach I'd probably seen and High Noon and stuff like that. But, you know, they were movies that I liked and I appreciated them and I knew why people considered them to be important movies. But, you know, I went into The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly with an expectation of it being a Western and what that genre means. And I was just totally, I don't know if I've ever been more surprised by a movie than I was the first time I saw that. And, you know, I hadn't read much about it. I had seen probably a couple of Tarantino movies, which to me were, you know, they were outrageous. And I was sort of in love with that energy and, you know, looked at it and said, man, where does something like this come from? And then when you see the good, the bad, and the ugly for the first time. It's almost like it felt like an archaeological discovery to me, because I was like, oh, they did stuff like this in the 60s. Like, I guess before that time, I sort of thought there was no such thing as sort of really outrageous style in a movie until, you know, something like 1991. And then when I saw that movie, I was like, oh no, this happened already. They've been doing this for 40 years. And so it just blew me away. And it so isn't, there's really no reason to even call it a Western other than the setting, because the elements of that movie make it into something wholly different than, you know, than a traditional genre movie. In a way, it became its own genre, you know, and I think obviously it has predecessors that sort of built up to it, but even if you see the other two Leone movies before that and then you see it, there's clearly just a huge jump that he made to that movie, and it's just a brilliant piece of, you know, visual art. It doesn't even always concern itself with telling a story, and I think those are some of its best moments, when there's not really any narrative happening, almost comedically long stretches of that movie in which no narrative is advancing. But it just sort of really opened up the boundaries of what I could expect from a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Every square inch of the screen is used in every shot of that movie. And it's such a fun movie. When I was going through that similar phase, I was like a Once Upon a Time in the West devotee, you know, because it's the more kind of prestigious and regal of Leone's kind of sprawling westerns. But as I get older, you know, it's like, well, which one do I really feel like watching? And it's like, well, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly is not just, you know, it doesn't just have all that majesty and grandeur and style, but it's also just a lot of fun, you know, and Eli Wallach is a blast, and Eastwood is just always magnetic, and Lee Van Cleef is so menacing at all times. It's not just this big, you know, icon of cinema. It's also just a really fun adventure movie.
Yeah, and like I said, just stylistically, it just kind of blows your mind to see someone doing something like that, that they had so little regard for what a movie was supposed to look like. You know, I can't imagine how people reacted to it when it first came out, because, you know, you're not supposed to have these weird... I mean, where did that music even come from, right? I mean, it's surf guitar and weird harmonica and vocalizing things. It's just, there's somehow, it all works to us now because it's so permeated the culture. But, you know, on paper, it's just the weirdest gumbo of stuff all thrown together that somehow, you know, turned into this really cool experience. But it's... You know, when we talk about how people, you know, that people don't have original ideas anymore, I think that's an example of somebody who took, you know, a bunch of other different pre-existing things and tweaked them in such unexpected ways that there's no way anybody could have come out of that movie and said it was, you know, derivative or looked like something that came before it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right, well... I feel like I have a good guess, and I'm kind of making a bet with myself internally as to what your number one is, but I won't say, but I'll let you know if I
guess it. Why not? No, go ahead and guess.
Well, no, I don't want to be wrong and then have an awkward moment where where I took your glory.
Okay.
So just go ahead and go, and I'll let you, once you finish, I'll let you know
how
far off I was.
I'm going with Back to the Future at number one.
Nice.
Yeah? Was that what you guessed?
Nope.
Nope.
No, I went totally racist and was going to...
You went Goodfellas.
I was going to say The Godfather.
Godfather, too. No, that probably was my number one at some point.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I love that movie, obviously. But I think over time, what's happened with Back to the Future is I think the nostalgia factor plays into it, and that movie has been a part of my life since I was a kid. But, you know, I the more I watch it, the more appreciation I have for, you know, the incredible economy of storytelling, which is a very unromantic way to talk about a movie that you love so much. But I think what's so cool about it when you watch it from that perspective and you're trying to see how did they accomplish this? The test really that makes this movie so impressive is try to explain what happens in this movie to someone who's never seen it or heard of it before. And it'll take you a really long time because it's super complicated. And they get that across to you really without ever having to have a big, long, drawn-out, boring exposition scene. There are certainly scenes where the characters are explaining things to each other, but for the most part, that only covers a very small amount of the exposition that has to happen to get you into the situation that this movie climaxes with. And, you know, I think the scenes that people probably don't talk about quite as much are sometimes the scenes that when I rewatch it, I'm so amazed with. The scene near the beginning of the movie where the McFly family are all having breakfast. There's such an incredible amount of character development and story and background information and exposition all being done in what looks like a very pedestrian scene, but it's just an incredibly well-executed scene that sets up so many things that will pay off in the rest of the movie. And that really, that kind of, you know, economical use of scenes in the movie, that's kind of how the whole thing operates. There's so many things happening per minute in this movie, and they all matter and they all pay off, whether it's just from a fun gag or, you know, setting up interesting plot elements down the road or just developing characters. I just think every beat they make in this movie serves a purpose, and it does something to make the movie better. You know, every moment they give Biff, there's not a single moment that Biff is on screen in this movie where he is not being full Biff. Like, he is exploring what it means to be Biff every second he's on screen. And that's why we all have such a strong memory of that character and why we all, you know, love that performance so much, because there are no scenes that Biff is in where he is not 100% Biffing, you know? And I think that's true for some of the lesser characters too. I mean, Christopher Lloyd really didn't do a whole lot outside of this in his career that he's remembered for. And it's such a wonderful, endearing, weird character. And, you know, these performances are over the top, I think, in this movie, but they find a way to make it, you know, to make it sort of feel nostalgic. And, you know, just like I think all the scenes of the 50s in this movie are, you know, the decoration's probably over the top. It's probably an exaggerated version of what things look like. But this movie kind of lives in that hypercolor world of the 80s where everything was a little bit, you know, over the top. And I think that's part of why it sticks in our memories so much. But yeah, and the other thing too, I was talking about with Craig the other day was, you know, I think this is a really complicated idea that this movie's playing with. I mean, there have been time travel movies before, but, you know, they have some rules for themselves that they set up in this movie, and it's not easy to get them across, but they get it across to you in an interesting way, but they don't have to dumb it down for the audience. Or they choose not to, you know, and I appreciate that about it. I can remember watching it as like probably a 9 or 10 year old and, you know, remember watching it. And once it clicked for me, like what was going on, I remember thinking, oh, this is the coolest movie I've ever seen. But they never had to, you know, stop and dumb it down for me. They didn't have to talk down to the audience to explain how it all works. I just feel like, from a screenplay standpoint, it's so well constructed. And then on top of it, Robert Zemeckis made just a really great looking, iconic looking movie that really sticks in your head. And it also has one of my favorite scores of all time. So I guess this is just like, this is everything that I love about movies. It all happens at an A-plus level in that movie.
Yeah, what a great pick. It's definitely one that I've seen that maybe Back to the Future and Tim Burton's Batman are the two movies I've seen more than any other because of you know, watching them over and over and over again as a kid. And you're right, that first act gets so much information across that you don't even realize. And you know, and I was thinking you were saying there's not really any long exposition scenes. And I was thinking, I guess the longest one would be, you know, Doc showing Marty the time machine. But because of the things that they did in the script and Zemeckis does with the shots and everything, it never feels like nothing's happening. You know, it's
interrupted by Libyan terrorists shooting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. or you know, they're having to, you know, they're getting in their containment suits and he's got the video camera. He's trying to figure out how to work that thing. And then they have little asides about the stolen plutonium. And there's always something interesting going on. There's always something visually engaging. And you think from the very first shot in the movie, you know, that long take that sets everything up. Yeah, it's so much information packed in, but it never stops being engaging and fun. And I like what you said about the 50s and the 80s. It's like, yeah, the 50s in that movie are the 50s we wanted them to be. But it was made in the 80s, and it was a version of the 80s that we wanted it to be. You know, it was, like you said, the fantasy was in both time periods. And
yeah, the whole movie is basically built upon the fantasy of what if the 60s and 70s never happened? And it explores that. I mean, they literally skip it in a time machine, but I think that sort of permeates everything about the 80s-ness of that movie, too.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. Even down to the Huey Lewis soundtrack in a
yep.
crazy way. Yeah. I mean, it's a great movie, and I think that the way that you picked your list is, I think it's, we didn't talk about this, but I feel like it's like kind of how all of us picked our list, was where we have our top tens or our top 25s or whatever, and we have our, you know, intellectual picks and things like that. But then when it comes down to just picking three, and seeing what you got to leave out to make those three, to make that list of three, you kind of realize how personal some of these things are, and which of those more intellectual picks you can just kind of let go of. So
I think if you'd asked us all to make our top three when we were in college, it would have been a list that was probably built a lot more on trying to display our knowledge of great cinema. And I think maybe now as people in our 30s, this is just more like, you know what, I like what I like, and these are movies that kind of say who I am as a movie fan, more so than, you know, prove my cred.
Right. Yeah, Battleship Potemkin would have most definitely been on my list.
yeah, I had the same top three for a long, long time, which was Citizen Kane, Casablanca, and The Godfather. And I love those. I legitimately love those movies, but I don't watch them, you know, once a year on DVD like I used to. And there are other movies that I definitely can't go for too long without seeing.
Well, it's interesting because very few Film Nerds Unlimited listeners know that you were actually the primary curator of the IMDb Top 250 for about 15 years there.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just such a big fan of the Transformers movies, and I'm trying to get them back to the top, but it takes a lot of work.
They took your card away. All right, cool. Well, thanks, man. Thanks for talking to me about your list, and looking forward to another 100 or more episodes of Film Nerds Unlimited.
Hello, Film Nerds Universe. It is me, Franco, with a cold. Thanks for having me on, and thank you, Ben, for giving me the impossible task of naming three of my favorite films for this happy 100 episode anniversary. So I have this really long list that I keep. It's about 150 movies or so long of, like, movies that I feel like are, like, the Franco canon. So I was looking at this list, and I was seeing some trends that that were popping up, and then I picked three movies that kind of talked about those trends. Well, I picked, like, 12 films, and then I looked at them and saw, okay, where are the trends in three that could be representative of kind of the things that I like in movies. So the things I like in movies, I like films that deal with hypocrisy in, like, class or society in general, or, you know, the system keeping people down and people trying to kind of rebel against it. So I like films about that deal with oppression or repression. I also like movies about, like, the seedy underbelly of regular society. I like films that have a tinge of that are a little bit about maybe nostalgia or like things are changing and things are new. And I also like genre films, and I like foreign films, and I like films from mostly the 50s through the 80s. Although I do like a lot of stuff from 20s, 30s, and 40s, and some 90s stuff, and, well, I, you know, every year's good. Here are three films that I picked. I picked Billy Wilder's The Apartment, because it's classic Hollywood, which I like. It's a comedy, which I like. It's got Jack Lemmon. He's really funny. Billy Wilder's one of my favorites, and I like that I can time travel when I see an old movie to New York that no longer was, where you could have an apartment in Manhattan for like $50 a week. And I think that's what it was. And I also like that it deals with hypocrisy, and it's a Christmas movie. Next up is Aguirre, The Wrath of God, directed by Werner Herzog from the 1972? I don't know. So that deals, so that checks off the foreign film and 70s. Oh, and I also like, I forgot to mention, films that are like people dealing with like existential crises and kind of man's place in the world and man versus nature. And I really like kind of DIY films that are just, you know, that like the movie just had to be made no matter what. And I think Aguirre, The Wrath of God is a good example of that. And third but not least, David Cronenberg's The Fly. That film transcends its genre. It's about more than just a gore fest. It was made in the 80s, which is a good decade for genre films. And it deals with what it is to be human and all that sort of existential things that great art can have me think, which I love to do. So here are just quickly the other films that I had in consideration. La Grande Illusion by Jean Renoir, 1937. Alien, All That Jazz, Blue Velvet, Brazil, Taxi Driver, A Face in the Crowd, Crimes and Misdemeanors, RoboCop, and The Battle of Algiers. So that's it. I'm sorry I went a little over 4 minutes, but thanks, and here's to 100 more. Yay!
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com.